we spent the first 2 weeks of our Leviticus study simply preparing the background and laying the groundwork to make Leviticus more understandable, enjoyable, and hopefully meaningful for you. Now, I'd like to reiterate from an earlier lesson a few principles that we need to keep in mind all during our study. First, this is so important. God divides, He elects, and He separates. That is, Jehovah draws very strict boundaries. He makes hard and fast distinctions among people, among nations, among worship practices. He is intolerant of evil and sin, and He reserves unto Himself the exclusive right to pronounce which is which. He excludes those who are not His people. And at the time of Leviticus, His people were only the people of Israel. Second of all, Leviticus offers us the priestly worldview. It is written through the eyes of God's newly ordered group of priests who come exclusively from the tribe of Levi. Third, God classifies sin in two basic categories, intentional and unintentional. This is quite different from the typical way we humans think about sin, which is more along the lines of big or little, trivial or terrible, inconsequential or salvation threatening. And fourth, the sacrificial system we're about to study does not deal with intentional sins. All this is so important to understand. It doesn't deal with intentional sins, so it does not provide a means of reconciliation with God for deliberate sin. It deals only with unintentional, and nothing we will read about in Leviticus will reconcile the offender with God if that offender's sin is considered high-handed or great, which is Bible speak for intentional. The sacrificial system is about more than atoning for sin. We're going to see that several of the God-ordained sacrifices have little relationship to sin. Sixth, that while Yeshua fulfilled the sacrificial system, He fulfilled much more than the rather limited abilities of the sacrificial system to atone for a certain category of sins. And seven, the foundational principle behind the sacrificial system is substitution. That is, the deaths of animals were going to take the place of, they were going to substitute for, what rightly should have been the deaths of the humans who were guilty of sinning against Jehovah. Eighth, Leviticus is the middle book of the book series of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. We need to read Leviticus as though it's just a continuation of Exodus, which then eventually just rolls right on in to Numbers. So, open your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 1. Leviticus chapter 1. Adonai called to Moshe and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, and he said, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any of you brings an offering to Adonai, you may bring your animal offering either from the herd or from the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he must offer a male without defect. He is to bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting so that it can be accepted by Adonai. He is to lay his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. He is to slaughter the young bull before Adonai, and the sons of Aaron, the Kohanim, the priests, are to present the blood. They are to splash the blood against all sides of the altar, which is by the entrance to the tent of meeting. He is to skin the burnt offering and cut it in pieces, and the descendants of Aaron the priest are to put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. The sons of Aaron, the priests, are to arrange the pieces, the head, and the fat on the wood which is on the fire on the altar. He is to wash the entrails and lower parts of the legs with water, and the Kohen is to cause all of it to go up in smoke on the altar as a burnt offering. It is an offering made by fire, a fragrant aroma for Adonai. If his offering is from the flock, whether from the sheep or from the goats, for a burnt offering, he must offer a male without defect. He is to slaughter it on the north side of the altar before Adonai, and the sons of Aaron, the Kohanim, the priests, are to splash its blood against all sides of the altar. He's to cut it into pieces, and the priest is to arrange them with the head and fat on the wood which is on the fire on the altar. He is to wash the entrails and the lower parts of the legs with water, and the priest is to offer it all and make it go up in smoke on the altar as a burnt offering. It is an offering made by fire, a fragrant aroma for Adonai. If his offering to Adonai is a burnt offering of birds, he must offer a dove or a young pigeon. The Kohen is to bring it to the altar, snap off its head, and make it go up in smoke on the altar. Its blood is to be drained out on the side of the altar. He is to remove the food pouch and its feathers from its neck and discard it on the pile of ashes just east of the altar. He is to pull it open with a wing on each side, but without tearing it in half. The Kohen is to make it go up in smoke on the altar, on the wood which is on the fire, as a burnt offering. It is an offering made by fire, a fragrant aroma for Adonai. Okay. The first words of Leviticus, "Now he called to Moses," are in Hebrew, Vayikra, Vayikra. And Vayikra is the name the Hebrews give to this book that Gentiles call by its Greek name, Leviticus. Now, though these first few words, "Now he called," sounds kind of quaint to us, they carry a weighty meaning that's important for us to grasp. Yehovah is about to make a formal, very important pronouncement. Just like when our president might occasionally make a speech from his desk in the Oval Office, we understand that that what is about to come carries much more importance and significance than just a regular news conference or interview. When something happens from the Oval Office, it's a special event. The protocol here at the opening of Leviticus is much like it was back in Exodus when Yehovah called to Moses from the summit of Mount Sinai in order to bring Moses up to give him the law. But this time, Yehovah calls to Moses to give him the all-important sacrificial system that could appease God's wrath at men when they offend God. Now, allow me to repeat something I said to you at our last meeting. The sacrificial system and the law are the two primary components that together makes up God's justice system. In Hebrew, his mishpat. And that while in everyday common conversation, a Hebrew would usually call every element of God's justice system the law, with the sacrificial system just as part of the law, the way the sacrificial system and the law function make them somewhat separate. The law and the sacrificial system each have different functions, very different purposes. The law leads to punishment, while the sacrificial system leads to atonement, forgiveness, coupled with reconciliation. Now, the term "the law" has become very general, so much so that it is widely misused, misunderstood, even among Jews. It is especially misused and wildly, and I think to a degree willfully, misused within the Christian church. Let me explain. Even though we don't see Yehovah pronounce what can accurately be called the law until about halfway through the book of Leviticus, Jews will commonly call the term use the term the law as a synonym for the entire Torah. That is, sometimes they'll just call the entire first five books of the Bible the law, even though the law isn't even given until Exodus. And in addition, we must remember that the Jewish people also have other law called halakha, taken from non-biblical sources such as the Talmud, that they call law. What it actually is rabbinical law. So the Jews tend to call any and every religious instruction, whether from scripture or whether it's from the rulings of their religious leaders or even general commentary from their greatest rabbis, the law. So the law can be a very confusing term. The best analogy I can think of is that in the church, we have a lot of people walking around with only a New Testament in their hands. And sometimes a brand new Christian will only even have the first four gospel books. That's all they'll carry around. And if we ask them what they're holding, they're going to answer the Bible. Now that really isn't accurate, right? Since what they have is just a small portion of the Bible, but we know what they mean. We understand this. We'll also commonly hear a pastor or a minister preach, say he's teaching the Bible. Well, more often than not, what he's actually teaching is a doctrine, a denominationally based church tradition that is said to represent a biblical principle. And in both cases, Gentile believers who speak Christianese completely understand what they're saying and what they mean, even though technically it's not accurate. This analogy is the same as it is with the Jews who use the term the law. It could mean any number of things, and we have to discern from the context what any particular usage of that term is referring to at the moment. Now, notice here in Leviticus how God makes a formal separation between the law and the sacrificial system. Remember the importance of that little phrase, "Now he called." It denotes a cardinal event is about to unfold, something of great magnitude. And we received essentially this same preamble from God as he instructed Moses to come up to Mount Sinai to receive the law, to receive the Torah. Now, in a separate event, Jehovah again pronounces this important preamble, "Now he called," and this time God is going to give Moses the sacrificial system. So first, back in Exodus, God gives Moses the definition of sin, which is contained in the law, and the consequences for sinning by breaking any of the ordinances of the law code. Further, by the giving of the law, the Lord has set out the moral choices in front of Israel. Moral choices that the wills of each Israelite will decide to obey or disobey. Now, in Leviticus, God is giving Moses the other part of his justice system, the part that provides for atonement when somebody sins and breaks the law code. You with me on that? Of course, as we know now, this atonement is only available for a certain class of sin, the class that's called the unintentional sin. And by the way, I'm going to remind you of this over and over again, because it is primarily this attribute of the sacrificial system providing atonement only for sins that were not deliberate that causes Paul to characterize Christ's sacrifice as superior, and the sacrificial system portion of the law as inferior when you compare the two. And verse 2 makes it very clear about one of the principles that I enumerated for you just a few minutes ago. Jehovah is speaking to B'nai Israel. He is speaking to Israel, who is his people. Nobody else at this time were his people. Now, the Old Testament is positively loaded with this Hebrew term B'nai Israel, which literally means the young of Israel. However, it's usually rendered the children of Israel. At least it was in Bible times. The meaning, however, is probably best expressed in modern Western thinking, at least, as the Israelite people. Now, this expression is not meant to mean only the young. It's not referring just to children. It is not meant to refer only to those with Jacob's blood in their veins, that those that were genealogical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for thousands upon thousands of foreigners already had and would continue to keep joining with Israel. B'nai Israel is a national term. It refers to the group as a whole. And in this case, it's a lot like saying the American people. Now, with that stage set, that is, we know who's speaking, Jehovah, where this is taking place, at the Wilderness Tabernacle, and that God is addressing himself to Moses and to the nation of Israel as a whole, we are now given an instruction on the first type of offering, or the first type of sacrifice. It is the burnt offering. And in verse 2, when we're told that if anyone brings an offering for Jehovah, the word used for offering is korban. Korban. This is a good word to memorize, because it's a common Hebrew word that means any offering, any kind of offering. It's like at church, where the term offering could mean anything from money to property, even to personal time. And the offering could be for the general fund, it could be for something specific, it could mean our regular tithe, it could mean something above the tithe, irregular giving, if one doesn't tithe, or perhaps it's just a token donation while visiting a church or a synagogue. So the korban is not the specific name for a particular class of sacrifice called a burnt offering. Each class of offering, each type of korban we're going to encounter is going to have a specific Hebrew name. And in the case of the burnt offering, it is olah. Olah. Now, olah is the original Hebrew word that we almost universally translate as burnt offering. Now, I'd like to get a little technical here for a moment. The term burnt offering is what scholars call a functional definition or a functional translation of the Hebrew word olah. We're going to encounter a lot of these so-called functional translations in the Torah. What that means is that it's not a literal translation of that Hebrew term, because the literal translation wouldn't mean a thing to us. In fact, sometimes the literal translation is not even known. It can't be agreed upon by Bible scholars and translators. Literally, olah is thought to mean either ascend or go up or to bring near. Literally, that's what it means. So most literally, olah would translate as a near offering or an ascend offering. Now, that's so peculiar to our culture and our ears that the translators thought it would serve no purpose to translate it that way. So instead of giving it a literal translation of the word olah, it was determined to be better to give to the readers the function or the purpose of that offering. And that function is as an offering to the Lord that's burned up with fire on the altar, hence a burnt offering. So burnt offering is how olah is typically translated, and it's not wrong. It just doesn't include the sense that by burning up the offering, it emits smoke, which brings it near to God by ascending up to him in heaven. That's the idea of it. Now, I'm not necessarily going to break down the names of every sacrifice to the tiniest detail, like I just did with the olah, the burnt offering. I simply want you to understand what a functional translation is, and that many times in the Bible, we're going to get functional rather than literal translations of words. And there's nothing wrong about that. But sometimes we can get a lot more understanding if we'll also examine the original Hebrew word and go ahead and translate it literally, because then it exposes the Hebrew mindset and the Middle Eastern culture of that era. It helps us to get a better idea of what those people's mental picture was when they were doing these things. And in the case of Olah, the near offering, or the ascend offering, that we commonly refer to as the burnt offering, by looking at the words literally, we see that it is the smoke, and where that smoke is going, that is the key element of the effectiveness of that offering. And I'm going to show you why the smoke is so key in just a moment. Now, the type of burnt offering that we see here in chapter 1 is what I would best term a personal offering. That is, this offering, several other offerings we're going to study, is made by individuals, by private persons, on behalf of that person. This is opposed to later on in Leviticus, we're going to see special offerings and sacrifices, including burnt offerings, that are made on behalf of the nation of Israel, national offerings. This sets up an important principle that's used throughout the Bible, that God deals with Israel and he deals with us on both an individual level and on a corporate level, a group level. That corporate level could be a church, that is, all believers. It could be a nation, could be a family. When we read end times prophecies, we'll read about God making a distinction among individuals. For instance, he'll put a mark, we're told, on the foreheads of certain people, chosen person by person by person, for the purpose of keeping them safe and for the purpose of identifying those who will be saved, as opposed to those who are unmarked, who will be damned. But we also see God deal with entire nations. For instance, we're told that nations that come against Israel will be destroyed. So the burnt offering of Leviticus 1 is a personal, individual offering of sacrifice. It's also technically considered a food offering. Now, meat was a luxury item in the time of Moses. Still is. It still was in Yeshua's day. So while the entire animal used for a burnt offering was killed, it was thrown onto the altar to be completely burned up, that was not the case with other types of animal sacrifices. Rather, there was a procedure in which only certain parts of the sacrificial animal were put onto the brazen altar to be consumed by fire, and then the remainder of it was allowed to be used for food. Depending on the situation, it would be eaten by the priests, or it would be eaten by the person who brought the sacrifice, or in some instances, it would be shared among them. In fact, in general, it was only the more well-to-do Hebrews who ate meat that was not used first as a sacrifice because it was so expensive. Now, let me say that again. For the average Israelite, all the meat they ate was the leftover portion of a sacrifice, even though the law gave them permission to eat meat that was not part of a sacrifice. Now, in the burnt offering, the entire animal, except for the skin, which was given to the priests, was consumed by the fire on the altar. Now, imagine how people who had very little meat felt every time they took a sheep or a goat to the altar and watched it go up in flames. See, this was an expensive offering, and it indeed represented a personal sacrifice for that typical Israelite family to give up such a valuable animal. These families deprived themselves in order to give Yehovah what he instructed them to give. Now, the burnt offering could be used for a whole range of domesticated animals for sacrificing, and all that ranged from bulls to sheep, and we are just told all the way down to pigeons and doves. And the reason for this was a very practical one. Poor people simply did not have the money or the means to sacrifice a ram or a bull. Last week I pointed out that the size of the sacrificial animal, or its inherent value, a bull usually being the largest and most value, a dove being the least, had nothing to do with the measure of seriousness of a sin that was being atoned for, or in pleasing God more or less. Notice as well that I said domesticated animals were specifically called for as sacrificial animals. Animals that were typically grown for food purposes were the kind that was to be used for sacrificing on the altar. No wild animals were allowed for sacrificial purposes. You couldn't kill a deer. You couldn't kill a mountain goat and then use them for a sacrifice. The olah was the most regular type of sacrificial offering, offered in the mornings and the evenings, every day, offered more frequently during the day on special holy days. And as a general rule, the sacrificial animal had to be at least 1 year old, a male, and unblemished. That is, it couldn't be sickly, it couldn't be lame, it couldn't be deformed or injured, not even cosmetically abnormal, like with a twisted horn, or could it be of a strange color. It had to be your best animal, as near perfection as was reasonably possible. Now here's how the ritual worked. First the worshiper brought the animal to the tabernacle to be inspected by the priests, to be sure the animal conformed to the requirements of being without defect, of the proper kind, of the proper age, and then each worshiper would bring their animal through the large gate on the east end of the outer courtyard that surrounded the tent of meeting. They'd stand in the northeast corner of the courtyard waiting for their turn. Next, when a priest became available, as we're told in verse 4, the worshiper would lay his hands on the head of that animal. Now, this laying on of hands is something we could probably spend an entire lesson talking about. But generally, the idea was this. By the worshiper laying his hands onto the animal before it was killed, it was an official acknowledgement that this particular animal was being assigned as the sacrifice on behalf of that individual who was laying his hands on the animal. And at the moment, the life of the animal, the moment they did that, the life of the animal was being turned over to God. The Hebrew word for this laying on of hands is semekah, and it is most often used in the Bible to refer to a person, an authority, assigning someone or somebody a task. Or it's about the transference of authority. For instance, when Moses handed the task of leading Israel over to Joshua, he laid hands on Joshua, thus acknowledging the transfer of authority from Moses to Joshua. The same idea applies here with the sacrifice. The owner of the animal, by laying his hands on the animal, signifies this animal has been designated for the purpose of being a sacrifice on behalf of its owner. But that's not all it signified. There also seems to be some element of transferring the guilt of the owner of the animal's owner onto this animal's head by laying his hands on it, semekah. And therefore, by transferring the guilt to the animal, the killing of the animal now substitutes for the death of the worshiper. However, that meaning only applied to certain kinds of sacrifices, meal or grain offerings and thanks offerings, for instance, had nothing to do with sin. So that wouldn't have been appropriate. And while the laying on of hands in certain sacrifices indicates both a transference and a substitution. That is, the guilt or sin of the worshiper is transferred to the animal, and then the animal becomes the substitute for the worshiper. It was primarily the fascinating ritual of the scapegoat, where the transference of sin concept was best displayed. In the scapegoat ritual, it was from all Israel to the scapegoat that the sins of the nation as a congregation were transferred. And we're going to study that real closely later on. Now, we have record of other cultures of that day, even earlier, performing similar acts for similar reason. For instance, in the Hittite culture, a woman hoping to become pregnant would touch the horn of a fertile cow in hopes of transferring the fertility of the cow to herself. Now, though we're not told so, it's very likely some type of prayer was said or psalm was sung as hands were being laid on that animal, probably both by the worshiper and the priest. There are a lot of biblical psalms and other songs from Hebrew tradition that mention burnt offerings, and very likely one or more of those was used. Psalms 40, 51, and 66 were almost certainly eventually used during this portion of the sacrificial procedure. Now, I say eventually because the Psalms weren't even written for 300 years or more after the Wilderness Tabernacle was built. And second, because as I mentioned in my introduction to Leviticus, we know that the sacrificial procedures changed and they evolved over the centuries. Well, after laying hands on the animal, it was then killed. It was the worshiper, not the priest, who killed the animal. And this was accomplished at the north side of the altar. Now, probably the animal, depending on the kind, was tied to one of the four horns on the altar, then its throat was slit. Now, actually, what the procedure did was to cut the main artery going through the animal's neck, thereby causing almost immediate unconsciousness and death. The Bible uses a very specific word for the slaying of a sacrificial animal, shahat, shahat. And its meaning includes the exact way that the animal was to be slain so as to be as humane and as painless and as quick as possible. And it was done in a manner that would allow some or all of its blood to be captured in an authorized sacrificial vessel. The blood was then offered to God, and finally it was splashed on the sides of the brazen altar. Next, the animal was skinned. It was chopped up, sectioned into pieces. And typically the worshiper was also responsible to do this task, as well as to wash the inner organs with water. But that diminished over time, and the priests and the Levites took over more and more of that task. Then the attending priest would put these chunks of meat onto the altar one by one to be consumed by the fire. Now, a slightly different procedure occurs if the burnt offering, the olah, is to be a bird, because its size and anatomy makes cutting its throat and sectioning it impractical. Notice how the worshiper, the common man, performs most of the duties. The priest just officiates. He catches the blood in a ritual container. The priest splashes the blood on the side of the altar. The priest puts the meat onto the flame. And when we can visualize this scene, we begin to understand just how passive and sterile the church has become in our worship activities. Our involvement in worship is usually reduced to showing up. Maybe watching and listening. Not so by God's plan. The worshiper was an active participant in worship, in this case, the sacrificial procedures. Now, what was the purpose of the burnt offering? Well, as I told you in our introduction to Leviticus, not every one of the sacrificial system's ritual sacrifices was about sin. And interestingly, the very first sacrifice ordained in Leviticus, the olah was not for atonement of a sin that a worshiper might have committed, at least not in the way we think about it. Rather, it has to do, as verse 3 tells us, with asking God to accept you by allowing you, the worshiper, who brought that sacrifice, to come near to him. So peace with God is the aim. The olah was seen as a gift from the worshiper to God, a kind of combination gift and ransom. And even though the olah is technically classified as a food offering, it's not that the Hebrews thought the animal was somehow food for God. Rather, as I mentioned earlier, it's more about the smoke that was emitted from the burning flesh that ascended upward to God in the heavens that was in their minds. So that when God smelled the smoke, we're told, it was pleasing to him. It gave him pleasure because it indicated, A, that an individual was being obedient to his commands. B, peace. Shalom was being affected. In other words, God desperately wants men to be at peace with him. So much so that he set up this system that cost Yahweh millions upon millions of his valuable living creatures, creatures that he dearly cares about. But mankind meant so much more to him that he, for our sakes, didn't spare those beautiful, innocent creatures, and it pleased him to do it to attain his goal of peace with man. When Christ died, we're told, it pleased God to do it. It pleased him for his own son to be sacrificed because it brought man another step closer to universal and eternal peace with him. So it's the aroma of the smoke from the olah that pleases God. It would not be incorrect to say that the smoke of the sacrifice soothed God. This allowed God to have a more favorable attitude towards that man who was making the olah. But let's remember, a man did not bring a burnt offering when he committed a sin. That wasn't the purpose of this. It was brought regularly for the primary reason of maintaining a good relationship with God by means of seeking to please him, by means of obedience to God's ordained sacrificial rituals. The olah did not remove sin. It didn't in any way change the worshiper. That is, the worshiper's own sinful nature did not become transformed as a result of the burnt offering. Only God's attitude towards the sinner was altered. However, there is enough evidence in Leviticus and from various Old Testament prophets and even from the writers of the Psalms that some sort of atoning-like process was taking place from the ritual of the burnt offering. And the best way I can describe it to you is that the burnt offering had to do with man's overall sinful condition, not some act of sin, not a behavior, a wrong behavior that somebody's committed. And I think that atoning is probably not the best word for our Western culture, because atoning carries with the idea that something you did was brought before God, but with this sacrificial ritual, it was now wiped clean and forgiven. And it seems very clear that the burnt offering is not for wiping clean something you did. Rather, it's a gift of ransom because of who you are. A creature whose very nature is sinful. And this gift is necessary in order to allow you, an imperfect creature, to approach the most holy and perfect God. An olah is a voluntary offering from an individual. It's done as a matter of the heart. It is acknowledging one's corrupt condition. It signifies complete surrender to Yahweh's justice system, to his will. So as difficult as the semantics can be, when dealing with the Old Testament, I think the better way to understand the Olah is it paves the way for reconciliation between corrupt man and perfect God. It also wouldn't be wrong to say that the burnt offering offered a kind of protection from God's wrath upon you. Now, it's one of the better examples in the Bible of the spiritual significance of the burnt offering, which occurs even before the sacrificial system is given to Moses, is the near sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham. The elements are that Isaac was to be killed and burned up on an altar. And we can see from the story that this was also not about some kind of sin or another that Isaac or Abraham had committed. So what was this all about? As a burnt offering in Olah, it was about total surrender. It was about obedience to God on the part of the worshiper, Abraham. It also demonstrated the principle of substitution when Isaac was replaced by a ram that had been caught by his horns in some nearby thorn bushes. And the sacrifice displayed the idea of ransom, that Isaac was to be a price that was paid voluntarily in order that mankind could simply be at peace with God. Of course, it wasn't carried out because Jehovah stopped the process just short of Isaac's death. So why do all this? What was the point to put Abraham and Sarah and Isaac through this horrible ordeal only to pull up short? It was both a shadow of the future, Levitical sacrificial system. The Isaac incident actually took place more than 500 years before the Exodus. And of Jesus, who was even more future. And in the end, God the Father took Abraham's role, and Yeshua of Nazareth took Isaac's role. Only this time, Jehovah didn't stop the process, because this was the real deal. The sacrifice of Christ was what God had been preparing for since before he created Adam. Now, we will see as we move along that the burnt offering was often done in combination with other kinds of sacrifices, particularly if those other types of sacrifices were performed in order to atone for the commission of a sin, a bad behavior. But in chapter 1, the foundational principles behind all sacrifices are being established. And chief among these principles is that a priest from the tribe of Levi must officiate over the sacrifice. Otherwise, it's not only invalid, it's actually liable to bring defilement upon the holy sanctuary. Now, this is a large departure from the way things had been in Israel up to this time, because until these ritual laws were given to Moses, each Hebrew family performed their own rites, their own rituals, with the senior firstborn of the family acting as a kind of family priest. This centuries-old tradition was now outlawed, and it was turned over to this newly established priesthood of Israel. And by the way, Israel did not easily accept this new reality. And the firstborns of every family in particular didn't appreciate this loss of status that these laws of Moses took away from them. The other thing that we find is that only the priests are authorized to handle the blood of the sacrificial creature. And further, some amount of the blood from every sacrifice had to be captured. It had to be splashed onto the holy altar. If the animal's blood was not splashed onto the altar, the sacrifice might well have never taken place. It was invalid now. Blood is the whole point to a sacrifice. Now, we've lightly covered the reason for the requirement that the blood must be splashed onto the brazen altar in lessons from Exodus, and we'll cover it again. But suffice it for now to say that it was only by the means of the blood of the animal contacting the altar that the holiness of the altar infected that blood with its holiness. A preeminent biblical principle of holiness is that once God declares an object or a person to be holy, that state of holiness could theoretically be transmitted from object to object, object to person, person to person, and a person to object by means of contact. In the same way a defiled object or person who touches an otherwise holy or object or clean object or person, it can infect them with impurity. This is the reason that whatever is holy must be kept separate from anything that is common or defiled. In order that the blood of the sacrificial animal be efficacious, it must somehow attain a state of holiness, or it can't be presented to God. Neither the sacrificial animal nor its blood is inherently holy. Some magic thing doesn't happen when an animal is singled out as a sacrifice and its blood spilled, but that blood becomes holy the instant it comes into contact with the brazen altar. And the incredibly holy state of that altar of God now transmits its own holiness to the blood that's been splashed upon it. Now the blood is suitable for its purpose. Next week, we'll take up Leviticus chapter 2, and we'll discuss the next most common sacrifice, called in Hebrew the mincha. The mincha. Okay? That'll be for next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.